Another great week. Let's go ahead and start with the intro, as always.
Sit down and chop it up. Let's talk about it.
Well, let's ask the right question.
Who's convinced?
We're starting to see the mind bank stuff now.
It's What Do You Know With Joe?
What's going on, everybody? We have another great week of What Do You Know With Joe. As always, we've got Baxter. We've got Winnie. We've got Lindsay. The little nugget's doing great. This week, we have a great guest joining us. Olympian, X Game gold medalist, father, podcast host, NBC sports commentator for the Olympics, all-around great individual, Todd Richards. Todd Richards, as I mentioned, is all those things. And he would be on the Mount Rushmore of top snowboarders just because he is a very, he played a lot of pivotal roles for the sport. He's part of the main reason why we have what is known now as slopestyle in X Games and Olympics. And I think he's one of the great commentators of the sport where he educates people on what's going on. When you listen to the episode and you talk with Todd, he's very personable. He's very unique in how he speaks because he makes things very, very easy to understand. And he's also a genius. So he knows how to go in depth about it. We really had a good time speaking with him. I'm joined by my brother, Anthony. He and I have been snowboarding together since we were so little. So it was really, really fun to, you know, have him on and speak with Todd. You'll find some cool answers that Todd has to our questions. And all in all, it's just a great conversation. We're really excited for everyone to listen. With the holidays coming around the corner, and you're probably scurrying around saying, "Ugh, I don't know what to get to my friend or my significant other who's really into apparel or golf. What do I do?" Look no further. Go check out Sneakerhead Golf. They've got great apparel. They've got awesome club head covers that can integrate your favorite sports team or any interest you like. They have golf gloves. They have anything you need from a golf perspective or apparel perspective. I have a really cool hat and crew neck sweatshirt that I love. It's great. You can use my promo code JOE15 to get an additional 15% off, which is great because now you don't have to pay full price. Who doesn't love getting a discount? Again, it's JOE15, JOE15. Sneakerhead Golf Company. Go check it out. It's going to be great. Let's jump into the episode with Todd. Enjoy.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of What Do You Know With Joe? I have the great guest, Todd Richards, joining me. Todd is a professional snowboarder, commentator, dad, just an all-around great guy. Todd, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. Yeah. And as always, or not as always, I shouldn't say, but as before, I have my brother Anthony joining. Ant, what's going on?
Hello. Thanks for being back.
Yeah, of course. So I definitely want to, you know, just jump right in, Todd. You know, you were born in Massachusetts. Where in Mass? And what was that childhood like growing up there, man?
Well, I was born about an hour west of Boston in a town called Worcester. And if you're from there, you call it Worcester. And it's, you know, it was kind of one of those things where, when I was growing up, I was kind of short. I was really, really, really short, actually, until high school, end of high school. Didn't really excel at sports. Kind of just liked to play with toys and kind of just be in my own head, imagination-wise. And it was kind of a place where, if you're coming up skateboarding and you're coming up being different, like, you know, listening to punk rock music and skating, and this is like pre-snowboarding, you're not cool. this is the time where there was no safe spaces. You were abused on a daily basis, sometimes hourly basis.
Yeah. Hey, you know, it's, you know, sometimes it makes you better, sometimes it builds you a little bit up. So
yeah.
Was pretty much no, like what snowboard, like snowboard skate, that was like your main thing. You didn't really do a whole lot of other sports and whatnot, or traditional sports in that aspect.
Well, I mean, I grew up, like, I guess I grew up skiing, and then I grew up playing like Little League and stuff. And it was more like I was the dude in the Little League who like kind of never got to bat. And then when he did kind of get to bat, it was always like maybe you accidentally hit the ball. It was just like I was like the dude in the outfield who's like would just like sit down
picking daisies.
Like, why am I? Yeah, exactly, dude. Yeah. Just the guy picking daisies. But yeah, so it wasn't really until I think it was my sophomore year in high school that one of the kind of like the king of the dipshits that I hung out with was into skating, and just it kind of came with like listening to the Black Flag, Dan Kennedy, Circle Jerks, all these different bands that you just kind of had a skateboard. Like it was just part of like the thing. Mm-hmm. And while at that point, you know, I wouldn't call myself a skater. It was just like a life accessory. But then these kind of even older kids that had already graduated from high school had a ramp in our town. And I actually saw what like skateboarding was. It wasn't just like pushing from A to B. And that's when like everything changed. And like, it was like something to like, oh shit, like I want to do that, you know?
Yeah. So were your parents supportive of all this, or were they kind of like, we want you to go about this, or were they supportive of you just being you?
I think they're, I mean, I was a latchkey kid for sure. My dad worked, my mom worked. So I was kind of like on my own accord, which for better or for worse. So it was like, as long as I wasn't getting in trouble, you know, because life in the '80s was a lot different than it is now, as far as like, you know, getting into trouble and stuff like that. So it was like, as long as I was like not failing out of school and I wasn't running with like, you know, really sketchy people, I think my parents were really, they were tolerant. They weren't like, I wouldn't say they were supportive. They were very tolerant of what I was doing.
Some would argue that those times were better because it's
better. Mm-hmm. It's like the reverse helicopter parent. It's like when the helicopter leaves. Yeah, it was great, dude. Like, I mean, people ask me about that all the time. It's like, you know, you grew up, you didn't, you know, your parents weren't like around every day, but it was, dude, life was just so much different back then that if you kind of like grow to be self-reliant and it kind of serves you later on in life. You know, I never really thought about it as a negative at all. It was always like, whoa, I've got like, I can go and do whatever I want to go and do. And this is also at a time where like you could be in a different state because New England is so small that you could literally be in a different state and your parents just think you're down the street. Like if your friends had a car, you know, and like there's That's no cell phones, awful. There's no like, there's no nothing. So yeah.
The good old days. And so outside of like you mentioned Circle Jerks, those music, was there anything else that was kind of influencing you? And maybe like the, like you said, those older kids as well. Was there anything else kind of like attracting you to skating and potentially snowboarding? Was there anything that would kind of bring you in as well?
I think it was mainly just I could progress at my own pace. And it wasn't like a team sport where you had someone pushing you maybe to, you know, keep up with the team or whatever. It was like literally I could progress and have these little milestones for myself. It wasn't for somebody else. So that was like the first time in my life really that I was actually like, you know, good at anything as far as I was concerned. I mean, I could like draw and stuff like that and I had a great imagination, but like it was the first time where I could actually see progress happening.
Yeah.
You know, and that was pretty huge for me because I was kind of an introverted kid who basically was like raised by George Lucas. So it was like, you know, you know, to have like these little milestones was really, really fun.
That's cool. That's cool. And I know you got a piercing one next. But for those who don't know, and I guess, I mean, because my aunt and I snowboard, I wasn't really skating, but I think most people on the outside would be like, oh, they're probably pretty similar and whatnot. I guess what are two similarities of snowboarding and what are two huge differences of like skating and snowboarding?
So in the beginning, and we're talking about like in the late 80s when I first started snowboarding, snowboards weren't like they are right now. They were not easy to ride. Most ski areas didn't allow you to be on the hill. The first board that I had didn't have P-Tex. It also didn't have high backs. It was just like rubber straps. So it was like, really, dude, it was like, there was no support. It was basically like two water ski bindings kind of just parallel, you know, like in a sideways stance.
Interesting.
And you'd go to ski areas and like, no wonder they didn't allow you at the ski area. Cause these things were like death traps. Like seriously. Like if you weren't getting hurt, that thing would fly off your feet and just be like a wooden missile into like some family of four. So, you know, that at that point in time, you know, I like bought a snowboard because it, once again, like a friend of mine had one and we thought that we were going to be able to like beat the winners in New England because you know, the ramps and the streets would be covered in snow and do and find this other medium that we could like go and, you know, we're going to do all these skate tricks on this thing, but like, it just didn't work. Mm-hmm. But fast forward a few years, you know, and like, we want to talk about similarities standing when you have like a, when you kind of like live a sideways life where like surfing, skating, snowboarding, you have like your core balance translates across the different sports. So it's easier to pick it up and kind of wrap your brain around how the mechanics of it work. And also, you know, it was the same kind of a self-fulfilling lifestyle where it was like these, I was doing it for me. It's an individual sport. There's no team. So that's kind of how they're very similar and how they're not very alike.
For sure.
Real quick, about your time at UNH. Just tell us a little bit about that. And also, did that maybe help you propel your career into snowboarding?
So when I graduated high school in 87 and my parents were like, look, you're going to college. Cause that's kind of like what everyone did. You know, it was like, and I was at this point in time, I just wanted to go and skate and screw around. Like I didn't really, you know, I was good at graphic arts. I had a couple of years of graphic design in high school. So my parents obviously were like, we're going to get you into a graphic arts program because literally that's all you can do. And cause I wasn't like academically inclined. I just didn't care. I really didn't care. So I went to this school that was a subsidiary of UNH in New Hampshire. And they had a full graphic design program, which was cool. You know, I really liked the, I guess the graphic design, like the theory classes, like psychology of color, psychology of graphic design and what, you know, what people perceive and how to trick people's brains into like reading things a certain way. Like I'm still fascinated by that stuff, like advertising, things like that. But this was at a point in time where you would go to these graphic design colleges and it was like manual typesetting for newspapers. And I always joke about this, like my entire education that I had at this college was replaced by like two keystrokes in Photoshop. Like just, there you go. There's your 80 grand or whatever it was you spent on
right
college.
Down the toilet.
But we learned a lot about like manually setting up big Heidelberg printers to like run newspapers and stuff like that. So it was like that kind of a thing. But the good thing was, is that the school that I went to was right down the street from a mountain and I had access, like really close access. And at that point in time, snowboards were a lot better. They had become a lot more rideable. People had high backs, you know, and like clothing that was semi waterproof. So things kind of like accelerated after that. You weren't being trendy because you were wearing jeans on the hill. You literally didn't have anything but jeans on the hill. Like that was your snowboarding gear.
Busting ass and getting soaked.
Yeah, totally, totally.
sticking on snowboarding, now in the 90s, what were those competitions like?
So when I originally started to come up, there was like a couple little contest series around and I had done skateboard contests at that point, and I had done well at those, and so I kind of knew my way around like what a contest was. And there was a couple little contests that kind of popped up and I had, you know, there was like these entry fees that were like, I don't know, like $50 or something like that to enter. And you could win, like maybe if you won the overall, you could win like $500 or something like that. So I would go to my college and be like, hey, will you guys sponsor this? Because it's like a team, they had like a ski team and they had all these. So my college actually like helped me with my entry fees as an outreach sports program, which is pretty awesome. But the contests in the beginning were like half pipes were not good. It was basically like two piles of snow kind of across from each other. And, you know, it was more like a gathering of the tribes more than it was about like some crazy showcase of talent. Right. But you got to meet people from like as far away as, you know, Montreal and Quebec, and people would come up from New York and New Jersey. So we would meet all these different kids and start to network and build a whole network of friends that way.
Gotcha. That's fucking cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
How confident were you at that point with your skill compared to others? Did you think people were in the same level?
You know, it was like in the regional stuff, I think I was pretty confident because I had that skateboard background. It was really easy to translate it into doing like the freestyle tricks of the day, which was, you know, we're just emulating what we saw people do on skateboards. And I had that background. So I was like, you know, the big fish in this really little pond. And then I think it was the end of 1989 where the US Open of snowboarding was held at Stratton, and they had like a real half pipe. And I got to see like the people up close that I saw in the magazines. And I was like, whoa, like I am not here, you know? And it was like, it was That's a great cool. thing because at that point we didn't, you know, magazines were our only, it was kind of our only source of seeing tricks. And it was like, you know, we'd see this image of someone flying through the air doing something, but we didn't know how they got into that position. You know, it was just, we would just do our best to kind of like work out the physics of it and try to chuck yourself. But at the US Open, we actually get to see these people do these tricks in person. And that was a big, like, pivotal point in my pursuit of snowboarding at that point.
Speaking of US Open, how were those competitions, especially 94, 97, when you won those titles? How was that whole experience?
I mean, insane. I mean, the US Open, it sucks that the US Open doesn't happen on the East Coast anymore, because it was, you know, you want to talk about a massive gathering of the tribes. It was basically like a 6-day party that culminated with the half pipe event. It was the very last event of the weekend. People were just raging out of control. Like, you know, you think about like, you look at like a crowd at the X Games, the US Open crowd like quadrupled that. And it, for the most part, it was a bunch of drunk Vermonters or New Englanders were like in the middle of your run, like people would just start throwing beer bottles across into the crowd on the other side of the pipe. And like the crowd was just mashed in like a concert. Like it was a full gladiator pit. It was everything. So like to be from the East Coast and actually win that in the backyard and have these fans that are just rabid and wasted and just like, it was insane because people in there's snowboard fans are great across the world, but in particular in New England, the snowboard fandom was on another level. It's like basically take how people are about the Patriots and the Bruins and the Red Sox and just put that into a snowboard fan. It's awesome. Yeah, it was really, really cool.
maybe we should some sort of petition to get that back, because
they've been talking about it. You know, it's Burton kind of dropped the ball on it. It was something that was really special. They moved it out west. Mm-hmm. And then subsequently the US Open went away. But I think there's a group of people on the East Coast that are trying to put together something called the New England Open again and have it be what the US Open used to be. But you guys gotta go. The debauchery that would go down during there was always like these stories of like such and such team rider like flipped his car into a ditch and like, you know, like someone set fire to this house. It was just always like the craziest stuff. One time, I think Redman played at the US Open and there was like a riot, like a straight up riot, and it was just because everyone was so cold and wasted and no one ate any food, and then you have like Redman telling everyone to go crazy and like tear the place apart. Like everyone's like, okay, let's tear the place apart. Yeah, it was pretty awesome. Pretty cool times
running on fumes and just exactly saying, do it. Mm-hmm.
totally Totally.
I was gonna say before you go in, I wanna definitely maybe at the end we'll do it. I wanna hear maybe like you said, people flipping cars. But I'm sure there's one crazy ass like top story there that it's like, damn, that's that people would be like, holy fuck, that's wild.
Oh dude, I'll just get into it right now because it's so at that point in time, you know, this is one of the first US Opens that I went to. And I was like this young green kid who was so excited to be like part of this thing. And I'm staying with the Sims team at the Sims team house. And apparently earlier that night, legendary snowboarder Sean Palmer went to this party and lost his wallet. But okay. He was so wasted, he was convinced that someone stole his wallet. So he's like accusing everyone and he's just like belligerent, like just full dummy drunk.
Yeah.
And they're like, you need to leave. And he's like, you guys stole my wallet. They're like, no one stole your wallet. You're just, you know, you're a fool.
Yeah.
So on his way out, he picks up this log and throws it through the plate glass window of his house. This big window just blows this window out and then like runs away. So, so at like 2 a.m, I'm sleeping upstairs in this room. There's all these people in this house and someone, I feel someone above me. And then I feel someone's finger on my forehead. And it's just like poking me in the forehead and it's going, where's Palmer? Where's Palmer? And it's this other legendary East Coast snowboarder, Andy Coughlin, who lived in Vermont going, where's Palmer? Just poking me like really violently in the forehead. And you know, like when people are like so wasted that they're like that hot, just drunk dude breath is I can just still remember the smell.
Oh, that'll work.
And I'm like, I don't know where Palmer is. I'm like 18, like, I'm like microscopic human being, like wasn't partying. I'm like, I'm here to do well in the contest. And I've got this like man poking me in the forehead. So I'm like, I don't know where Palmer is. So they just leave. And then I hear this commotion downstairs and I go downstairs and there's this Italian team rider that we had on Sims, and he's out in the hallway. All these other dudes are at the house trying to find Palmer. And there's this Italian dude in a Speedo. And this is like a Speedo in like 1989, 90. Like you didn't see too many Speedos around New England at that point.
Yeah.
And there's this Italian guy speaking in like broken English, like, you need to go away, like sound like a drunk Mario, like, you need to go away, you cannot do this in the house, like in a Speedo with nothing else on. And it was just like this crazy surreal moment. And then Palmer like walks in, he's wasted, and like it was just so insane. Like that was like my intro to like, oh, you want to be on the Sims team? Like this is kind of like what happens.
Work hard, play fucking hard.
Yeah,
too.
I mean it was nuts. I'll never forget that as long as I live. That was like
that's fucking.
I think I had PTSD. If anyone touches my forehead, I like freak out now.
I was gonna say, I bet you always will remember the smell of that breath forever.
Dude, it was heavy. It was like this close to my face, you know, like an inch off my nose, full open mouth, poking me in the forehead. And I'm just like, terrible. Wow. Okay.
That's fucking terrible.
Yeah. It was
the same house that had the window broken too.
No. This is where Palmer ran. This is like where the Sims team house was that they knew Palmer was staying.
Okay.
So yeah. I was going to say, we got to find that house.
That would have been late.
We got to find
that. Oh, I know where the house. I know exactly where the house is. I know exactly where the house is. Yeah.
And you go back. My bad. I just.
No. That's great. Transitioning a little bit into X Games now.
Sure.
How was the process like getting that skate style, that slope style into the games, and anyone that comes to mind that helped you accomplish that trend?
Well, I think at that point in time, like there was a couple of really distinctly unique styles within snowboarding. There was like this European kind of like racer alpine influence style that was more like Dayglow, like wherever your hand hits the board, where it hits, it sits. Like it's not like people weren't really paying attention to like, is this grab tight? Is it in the right place? Does this look good? So when, you know, I was part of this crew that kind of came up from a skate background and we were like really into making everything that we did on snow emulate skateboarding. So that was super, super important to us. So, you know, getting that going and then like, pushing that into, okay, well, we want to make it look like this in the half pipe. And we did that. And then subsequently a few years later, like slopestyle started, which was more kind of like almost like downhill street skating in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, it was more like there was more momentum going. You could really choose and pick your own line and you hit the jumps, you hit the rails, berms, things like that. And that's really for me, like when snowboarding was what really changed in into something that I really, really enjoyed doing, because it was more like I was just riding on the hill. It wasn't like half pipe's kind of like this gladiator pit where you start at the top, you end at the bottom, pipe is, you know, such and such a distance long, and you're confined in this tube. But slopestyle was like, yeah, it's top to bottom, whatever you want to do. There's no like prerequisite tricks or anything. Yeah. You just make your line look as good as you can.
That's pretty dope.
Yeah, it's fun.
Joe, I didn't know if you wanted to go. I can keep going.
No. If anything, also, like, what was that kind of like same kind of conversation in 97? Like, you got to compete in the first ever inaugural X Games. You actually won gold in thru-pipe. What was the atmosphere kind of like in that first competition? I mean, you're coming big from that US Open crowd. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what's that crowd kind of like? And, you know, what was the competition looking like in the first X Games?
Well, you got to think, like, there'd already been two X Games at that point, and they were both, they were summer X Games. They weren't winter X Games. So, and that was the first time that we ever saw, like, skating showcased in that kind of a format, like on ESPN. Like, they took it seriously. Like, you know, they had like sports announcers, and it was kind of a big deal. Like, there was nothing like that up until that point. So, you know, we being the skate snow community, we saw that as like, shit, like, we'd be so sick if we could get the X Games to do the winter. And so fast forward 2 years, all of a sudden the inaugural winter X Games happens at Big Bear, at Snow Summit. And these were all, it was an invite list only. It was, and that was kind of weird at that point too, because usually all these competitions would have, you know, an open qualifier that you have to show up 3 days before, and you'd have to like battle your way to the finals day. But this was like a hand-picked group of people to compete. And so it was a lot of the people that I had competed with before, but it was the first time that we had snowboard, like I said, like on ESPN, and it was showcased in a format where there was like a medal ceremony and this whole crazy thing where like, it was legit. It like added legitness to the way that it was showcased to the world.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of money behind it. There was a lot of push behind it. It was probably one of the biggest prize purses that I had ever seen up until that point. Mm-hmm. So it was really, really fun to do that. And I mean, it just kind of put things on the map. And it was like, I guess I didn't really realize the significance of it at the time, but you know, it's pretty cool to be like, oh yeah, I freaking won the very first Winter X Games.
Yeah.
Cause you think about where X Games is now.
Yeah. Right.
Arguably is kind of a shell of what it was in like the mid 2000s when X Games was like freaking crazy at its peak, you know? I mean, X Games in probably from like 2002 to like 2010 or 2014 was like, dude, there was so much money in there. Sean White was like, you know, pinnacle. There was all these, you know, it was just unreal.
Like competition from like Mark McMorris and like those guys. And like, and like, it's just like, shit, like this is good. Like all around competition. I got to ask too, before I jump to the Olympics, do you have any of those gold medals on you right now or near you?
I'm looking around. No.
I was going to say, I was so curious because I imagine like, that's the thing too, like medals, like how they look and the design and shit. I'm sure like that first one's probably kind of
fun. Oh yeah. No, they changed a lot. Like the first one we got was, it was very similar to the Summer X Games medals that were given out previous years. And it was really cool. It's just like this square with a X in the middle, and one was gold, one was silver, and one was bronze. And it was just, you know, it was really cool. But as you know, as the years go on, like the X Games medals and like what they hand to people, like the hardware, it's changed a lot.
Yeah.
You know, big time.
I mean, I think also you have the unique perspective of winning, but also being part of like that inaugural 1997 X Games. You also got to be part of like the first inaugural U.S. Olympic snowboarding team. Like,
yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that. And like, was that kind of like collected people as well, kind of like to the first X Games? And like, what was the crew like there? Hopefully it was kind of like the same team where you got to fucking rage and shit like that too. But like,
well, it was weird. It was kind of one of those things where we didn't know what to expect. You know, at that point in time, everyone was talking about the Olympics, the Olympics, the Olympics, the Olympics. And it was a big deal, but at the same time, there was like a lot of skiers and a lot of, you know, people that were kind of trying to tell us, because they had gone before, like for moguls or for downhill or for all these things. And they were trying to like give us all this information of what it was going to be like.
Sure.
And it kind of just like in one ear and out the other. And because, you know, we were snowboarders and, you know, fuck everybody and like that whole thing. So like we finally get to the Olympics and it was really intimidating because, you know, you don't really hang out, because I had friends from all over the world that I would hang out with on every weekend.
Yeah,
you weren't like really allowed to like hang, you know. Like I remember opening ceremonies before we walked out to the big opening ceremony where all the different countries are and we were like running over to our friends like in Norway, our friends over, you know, in Sweden or you know Canada, and their teams were like What are you doing? Like, why are you here? What are you doing over here? And it was just so, at that point in time, Olympics was very like team pride. Now it's a little bit different because there's just so many, you know, it's so global and everyone's friends. But at that point in time, it was really weird and everyone was really serious. And we weren't very, you know, we were serious about what we were doing, but we didn't really understand the significance of the Olympics and what it really meant. It really, you know, you go through the competition in 1998, it was kind of like we were the guinea pigs. They made us compete on this day that was like torrential downpour. Like every other event was canceled that day except for us. I didn't do so hot. I did pretty shitty. But you know, fast forwarding to in 2002, when we had the Olympics in Salt Lake City and the men swept, Kelly Clark won. It was beautiful and sunny out. The half pipe was absolutely perfect. The Red Hot Chili Peppers played at the bottom. It was like, this is snowboarding. This is snowboarding being showcased to the world. Like we had Chappelle was down at the bottom of the pipe. It was like the craziest thing, because it was like front and center and it was in the US, like the birthplace of the sport. And like, you know, birthplace of like action sports culture. And it was a far cry from what we experienced 4 years previous in 1998. I can tell you that much.
That's dope. That's
dope. Yeah. It was really cool. And since then, like since 2002, it's gone crazy. And I'll argue with anyone that these days snowboarding is the anchor for the Olympics at this point, for the youth. Yeah. For the youth, I'll say, you know,
I would agree with that for sure. Yeah. And did you, between like 1990 or between 1998 and 2002, did you see maybe a little bit more relaxed for like the rules, so to speak? Like, was it so that it, I'm sure that people were still very competitive, but
yeah,
was it a little bit more chill as far as like, you know, seeing your buddies from like Norway or Sweden?
Yeah, I think it was more relaxed in the sense of it became a little bit more snowboardy. But I think conversely to that, it became a lot more serious because people saw what could happen if you won the gold. I mean, it's funny because we had that American sweep in 2002. Ross Powers, Danny Cass, and JJ Thomas won for the top three. I mean, it was so big. And those guys were, I remember being in Salt Lake after they had won, and they were like royalty, like rock star treatment everywhere they went. So fast forward from that to 2006 in Torino, people, you know, people like Sean White were like watching these dudes being like, holy crap, if I win, like I'm going stratospheric with this thing. All I got to do is win. And that's literally when the legend of Shaun White kind of started was after him seeing those guys win and just said, I want that. I want to feel that. And that's shit changed after that.
I was going to say that dude became the flying tomato and the whole rest of the
I know. He went from the tomato to the tight pants king to like, he's been through a lot of different different phases, I should say.
Yeah, dude. That whole interview where he's like, I'm talking about Mountain Dews, baby girl.
That is the greatest, television interview of all time. I'm talking Mountain Dews, baby.
Yeah, that's wow. I was going to say, there ain't no way it's Mountain Dews. But jumping a little bit back to the X Games, you know, you were able to also win gold in 2000. I know we talked about like the jump, and Ant, we'll jump back to you for sure because I know you had some piercing questions. You know, we talked a little bit about like the differences between 97 and 2000 as far as like where the game was going. Did you maybe see, you know, the competition, like as far as like the crowds and like the way they were interacting, did that all change, or was it kind of like with the Olympics where like people were taking it really seriously and they were trying to win because they could get something from this? Like, was it almost like grown like even more, and it was like getting like to where it was like in the mid 2000s, or was it just kind of like, you know, still in the baby steps getting there?
No, I think at that point in time, the crowd started to get really big. And I think X Games did such a good job of having this like prestigious thing. Like X Games was huge. I mean, it was like, it was such a big thing for action sports in general. And they did a really good job of marketing the X Games to the fans. So first X Games was at Snow Summit. The next two X Games were at Crested Butte in Colorado. And then the one in 2000 was in Mount Snow in Vermont, which once again,
backyard,
East Coast fans, backyard, they come out of the woodwork. So like they're raging. Eminem played that night too. Like there was just like, so that, yeah, dude, like this is like when Eminem just was like popping, popping.
Yeah.
So it was crazy. And you had all these people and they were fanatical fans, and they would stand out there all day in the cold, and they were like appreciative of you putting on a show. So yeah, it did. The crowd started to get bigger and bigger. And you know, if you have an event like the X Games, and like, let's say you have the half pipe halfway up the hill, you know, like it's not at the bottom, you're not going to get the fans as if you had that thing basically in the base area where everyone can walk up and they don't have to buy a lift ticket. You can just get grandma and grandpa and, you know, your derelict friends that have no business standing on anything. You know, you get them up there and you pack it, and everyone has a great time. And I think that's what the X Games did in Mount Snow in Vermont, was they brought everyone to the bottom and really kind of had that festive atmosphere going on. Yeah.
That's dope. Because
that's what it's at right now, right? Like that, you got to double up to go see them.
Yeah. Well, you know, not really. Like it's on the hill, but as it is at it's at Buttermilk in Aspen. You can walk up, but it's at night, you know. And it's like, I don't know. It's kind of weird. Like I get it. Like you guys want to have a spectacle at night, but like you want to have people, you have it during the day, you know, you know, people don't want to stand around when it's below zero outside. That's why you notice they never really pan. They don't pan that camera because there's the fans that are at the bottom of the pipe. But when we were competing in our heyday, the sides of the pipe would have been packed with people. So not only the bottom, but the sides were like three or four deep. And that was because the pipes were at the bottom and it was during the day and it was like on a Saturday or a Sunday when you know, people had off from work. It was just a lot more conducive to that kind of an atmosphere.
I think we need to run that back.
Yeah.
I think we need to fix it back to that.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people that are thinking that way. You know, people realize that maybe, you know, what X Games did bring into snowboarding that was kind of on the bad side of things was like, it made snowboarding for TV. So it was way more like you were waiting for the cameras to roll. We're in a commercial. You can't go yet. Like that kind of crap, which as a competitor sucks. Like no one likes that. And you don't get that rapid fire craziness that you get from like a live event where you're only playing to the spectators that are there, you know? Mm-hmm.
I think it's especially with the way like the way streaming shit works nowadays. Like, I think you could easily do it to where like you don't have to cut to commercials and that crap, and you could have it.
Yeah,
like, something you could easily, especially in today's day and age, like the way streaming is, you could easily have it go that way.
Yeah, and I mean, look, the streaming has eclipsed whatever X Games numbers they claim they're getting on ESPN. It's they are not getting the market share that their live stream is getting. There's no freaking way. Yeah. No one's watching the X Games on ESPN proper because people don't have cable anymore. Like, it's just not a thing. So they've completely kind of changed the way that broadcasting works in these events. I mean, coming from my point of view now, where I do sports commentating, it's insane because it really is the Wild West. You have to have an equally robust streaming platform, and you know, where's this thing going to live? Is it going to live on, you know, are we going to stream this live on YouTube? Are we going to stream it on Twitch? Yeah. Like, where's it going to live? Because those numbers are going to like just shit on the numbers that people are going to like flick onto it by accident on NBC and be like, oh, snowboarding. And then easily first commercial shows up, boom, they're gone, dude. Like, they don't give a shit anymore. So that's really where it's at is streaming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's it.
Real quick, before we get into your commentating career, what was it like as competing as you're at your last X Games, as well as when was your last snowboarding competition? Was it a little bit of a bittersweet thing because you kind of maybe had some other things that you wanted to strive for outside of snowboarding, or like you said, for commentating purposes? But what was all that like? Was the end of your career?
God, I can't even remember when. Like, my last like big competition was probably the 2008. X Games, maybe 2010. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was 2010, and I was just going through the motions at that point. Yeah. Like, I had competed for so many years, I wasn't gonna freaking win. Even if I had the best run I could possibly do and did it perfect, there was like some 14-year-old that was like just shitting on my ability level. So I was, you know, I was thankful that they brought me in and let me compete, but that was like my last marquee event. I've competed in events since then, but they're all like, you know, it'd be like a skate snow surf event or like a legends competition somewhere. And though I still love it, I still think that stuff is really, really fun to do. So it wasn't really like a bittersweet, like, not like, like if you're thinking in comparison terms to like Sean White, like at the bottom of the pipe on one knee, like crying, like, this will be my last. Like, no, I was like, fuck, what time is it? Let's go get some dinner.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to do that again. Like, it wasn't even like, a thought, like, I'm kind of over it.
Yeah.
You know? No one gives a shit. You know, you just kind of move on to different things, but I guess, you know, in defense of how Sean kind of stepped away from it, like, competition was his life. Like, it was his identity. So to like hang that up was probably like a pretty bittersweet moment and a real lifestyle change for somebody. But that was the opposite of what I felt. I was like, what time is it? 6? God, we got to go get pizza. Like, that was like my thought process.
Joe, I'll send it back to you in a minute, but what was now transitioning into commentating, how was that transition, especially now that you're with NBC, and take us through a little bit of that part of your life now?
Well, I got hurt in the early winter of 2003-2004. I got hurt. I fell and snapped my arm like really horrifically, so I was out kind of early season. And I was, you know, going to do the X Games that year. And I remember getting a call from someone that were like, hey, you can't compete physically, but do you want to commentate this thing? And we as the riders would always talk shit on the commentators because they didn't know what the hell we were doing half the time. Because you'd watch it later and be like, what is he even talking? Like, was he even watching what was happening? Right. So it was it was something that I thought was important to give back to the sport, was like at least some respectful commentary that kind of showed that someone knows what's happening, that can like anticipate what's coming from one of the riders, knows the feelings of like if a trick is going right, if a trick is going wrong. So it was just kind of natural. And then, you know, after that, I got better and I competed. I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll just, I was over half pipe at that point. I just was sick and tired of competing in half pipe. So I said, hey, I'll compete in slope style, but I will commentate the half pipe at X Games and some of these other events. And then it started to be like the paycheck was as if I was winning these events. So yeah, I was like, you mean to tell me I just show up and jibber jabber for literally like an hour, like just for the finals, like jibber jabber for an hour and go home with the same amount of money as the dude that won. And I was like, why wouldn't I do that? It was like, you know, and I just kind of found my niche and it became, you know, became a second career that was like paralleling my, my snowboarding at that point. Like I wasn't out of snowboarding by any means, but I just was done competing, was just kind of filming and, you know, shooting photos and exploring kind of other aspects of it. So it was a great, great bookend to like to have to, and also somewhere where I could see myself going when my knees and back just decided to not cooperate anymore.
Quick question on that. I guess from an NBC sports perspective, who's probably the most chill like person either working at NBC sports with like whether it's like snow, like the Olympics or like that or like the course as a whole, who's like one person at NBC sports you met that's like, all right, this guy gets it or this girl gets it?
Well, I think, you know, we have really good producers at NBC and they may not be, you know, come from a snowboarding background, but they understand enough. And that this is why the people that are like the professional producers at NBC that have been there for years and years and years, they can go from doing a dog show to doing NHL to go right over into doing snowboarding or skateboarding. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And they, you know, the best thing about a producer is that if they're in your ear, they allow you to do what your job is, but they tell you where we're going, where we're coming from, and they make it simple for you to be able to do that and not be angry. Because what a lot of people don't know about producing sporting events, especially, is that you've got like a guy that your main producer is like the maestro in an orchestra.
Right.
And he's standing in front of a bunch of TV screens and there's all these minions around him with computers and Avid decks and things and pushing buttons. And he's like, give me camera four, give me camera five, give me. And like, sometimes we will only hear the calm, cool, collected producer going, all right, we're coming out of commercial in 3, 2, 1. But sometimes they will leave the mic open in the truck and you will hear the fucking anarchy that's going on. What the hell? Give me camera three, you idiot. We got to get this. Well, where are you going? What the hell are you showing me? Like that kind of crazy stuff that is going, we lost camera four. Oh my God, what an idiot. Like it's just this crazy chaos that's in there. Mm-hmm. So my hat's off to any sports producer that is in the truck and bringing these events to you, because we just, you know, if you're not in it, you don't know the crazy shit that is happening, you know, behind the scenes. But I'll say one of the most chill dudes ever, Mike Trico.
Really?
Yeah. Trico is awesome.
Awesome. I can see that.
And it was like one of those things where, okay, so he replaced Bob Costas as like the head of the Olympics. And Trico comes from football, right? So Trico came in and like, he's a big freaking deal, but me being dipshit McGee who only concentrates on snowboarding, skating, and surfing, like I don't know who Mike Trico is. I'm not like a big football head. So everyone's freaked out that like Mike Trico, oh my God, I got a photo with Trico. And he comes in to the first meeting that I ever had with Mike Trico was in Pyeongchang in South Korea. Mm-hmm. And he comes up to me and he goes, Todd Richards, man, love your work. And I'm like, A, how the hell do you know who I am? And he also knew he's like, you know, what are Sean White's, you know, I saw Sean White kind of got hurt doing the 1260 earlier, and he's rifling off all this shit to me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, holy cow, dude, you do your homework.
Yeah.
And you know, you get a chance to kind of like chit chat with these guys behind the scenes, and they are chill, and they genuinely care. Like Trico, he knows his shit, man. That guy knows his shit. It's awesome.
Impressive. I was gonna say, shout out to Mike Tirico. That's fucking cool.
That's
fucking awesome. As far as you mentioned, like doing like legacy competitions, and you comment and you do commentating for NBC. Are there other ways you stay close to, you know, snowboarding or the skating competition? Like, do you ever talk with, you know, younger athletes trying to, you know, grow, like they're trying to grow, or is there anything else besides, you know, competing in legacy tournaments and commentating that you do to stay close to it?
I think, yeah, I mean, myself and two other kind of legends within, I would say like on the agent side of action sports, we do this thing called Sports Management Mastermind that we kind of help to mentor young kids and their parents on their journey up and trying to figure out, you know, like, do you want to be GoPro? What do you want to do? Yeah. How do I get from amateur status to sponsored and, you know, maybe in the big leagues someday. So we offer these like online classes. It's a 5-week thing. Every Tuesday we do these classes, and it's cool because you get to interact with these kids. And then also, like, I'm like the de facto team manager for Quicksilver Snow. So I actually mentor these young up and coming like teenagers, like maybe 20, 21. So I'm in the van with these guys. I'm traveling around to different things with these, you know, they're kids. Like, I have a 21-year-old, you know, like as like my son. So I'm like rolling around in a car with these dudes and just trying to like make sure they don't like idiot themselves on the road. You know what I mean? Like, just try to keep the guardrails on a little bit, but it's fun. Yeah. And like, we have these conversations all the time, and usually it's like when you're in the van or when you're in an airport, and you'll kind of like tell them how it like used to be and like how not only the money that we used to make, but like just the crazy stories of
like the Palmer log story.
Yeah. Like that, or just traveling to go and do it, or like being, you know, chased by people for skating and like not having driving 3 states over to go find a ramp that you get directions to on a napkin, like that kind of like crazy stuff. And the kids are just like, really? Like, because now their parents are like, oh, little Johnny's gonna be Sean White, and they're just like pampered all the way up, you know what I mean? So to for those kids to like hear the raw scrappy struggle, I think is it's like hearing like fantasy stories to them. It's like not real to them. So yeah, it's fun to kind of like peel the onion back a little bit and be like, you know, you guys came from here. Snowboarding didn't start last year when you started.
Right.
It has a very deep history.
Oh yeah, I'm sure they have a lot to learn. I'm sure they would scratch their heads on a lot of those stories.
Oh yeah.
So maybe more towards your family and things like that, away from the slopes. And you know, maybe away from the skate park and the waves and things like that. What are some topics or things that interest you now, like that you may not have been maybe interested when you were younger, or like maybe just things that you found a love for that you're getting into? What are some of those things that you like doing?
I really, you know, I like helping do design stuff and marketing stuff for brands. I really love doing that, especially when it's like, you know, we need to have an idea session, sit down, anything goes, and trying to think outside the box. And there's a few brands that I work with in that capacity, is like an advisory capacity, that I love doing that stuff. Like love doing that stuff. You know, on the nerdy side of things, you know, I've gotten a chance to like consult for video games over the years.
That's cool.
Which is really freaking cool. And I'm not ashamed to say it. I'm a full-blown nerd gamer, you know, and that's what I do to like wind down is go shoot at 12-year-olds.
I was just about to say, what games are you rocking with right now? What are your top?
Well,
right
you now? Know, it kind of depends. It depends. I mean, it's like I'm pretty stoked for the new Call of Duty that comes out at the end of this month because I will be swearing at my television set for hours. Dude, I'm so sick of like children that are so much better than I am.
It's fucking crazy.
And they all leave the mic open. They all leave it open and like you hear their family like interact. Right? And I'm just like, shut up. Like just shut. And they're screaming at each other. Oh my God.
Oh, I love that. I
was gonna say, it's awesome.
We could probably go down the road on that, but the way like those kind of chats have progressed throughout the years, like you used to be able to say fucking anything back in the day against people, and now if you say one wrong word, some kid's gonna end your Xbox career and just report you, and it's game over.
You just get banned. Yeah. What happened to the good old days of swatting?
Yeah. Right? What where would that like, bring those back? You know, it made you better as a person.
I don't know if you want to bring that back. That's a little nice. But yeah, I mean like dude, that kind of stuff can be really, really fun.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm super into like the long form story games too, like getting lost in like The Last of Us for days, weeks, like that kind of shit. I really like. I love that medium of like really good storytelling that you're actually like kind of playing a movie. Like I love that.
That's fucking cool.
I wish I was in that industry. Because I can only imagine like, hey, we're gonna get all my homies together and we're gonna like come up with this game and just like sit in a room and throw out the craziest fucking ideas. Like that sounds so fun to me. Mm-hmm.
That no, I agree. I think a lot of people would like to get into that industry for sure. As far as like, I mean, you mentioned it with like mentoring those kids as far and like being in the van with them. Are there any like, because I like asking the question too, just because you learn a lot of things from it. Are there any like charities or like topics or those kind of issues that like you're really close to or like something that like you learned about maybe while you were getting part of it? If you don't, it's fine. And there's something if you do, I'd love learning about those too.
Yeah, I think like the mental health aspect of what like any pro athlete, especially pro athletes or up and coming athletes in action sports go through, and the journey with that has social media involved with it, and how to like stay out of your own head and how to like stay positive and do what you love to do and not get caught up in all that other crazy stuff. That stuff is pretty near and dear to me because I have two kids and I watch it happen. Yeah. You know, social media is the fucking devil you know, it's a necessary evil within my life because of, you know, you gotta be on social. So, you know, it's being able to navigate that space and come out the other side alive, quite literally sometimes, is pretty like pretty important to me. And giving, you know, these classes that we teach, one of the biggest classes that I really like to really get involved with is the one, it's the mental health aspect. And we have, you know, we have these sports psychologists come on and kind of like try to talk kids through like, you know, because kids that are coming up doing competitions, they maybe don't do well one weekend and they get so depressed. And so I remember that from where I was. And if I can help kids to go through that, allow that experience to happen, but not be defined by your 45 second half pipe run. You know what I mean? Like, it's the same as like not basing your self-worth on how many likes a post got, you know what I mean? Like that kind of a thing. That's what my passion would be in that's passing cool. on to the next generation. Yeah.
That's fucking cool. And I, like you said, I think it is such a growing topic that a lot of people one can relate to, but also like, really need to hear about and know that like things are like you're not just defined by that. So that's really cool.
Yeah, because kids just get rocked these days. You know, like their brains like when we were growing up, we're a little older. So like you can especially growing up back east, you can take a hit. Someone says something, it rolls off. You know,
right?
Our skin was a little thicker. The skin now is like translucent. You know,
no,
it's
I
like
agree.
They're so thin skin that it's like. Just trying to help these kids kind of move through that and be able to maybe have a little bit thicker skin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is my goal.
That's cool. That's awesome. Yeah. And as you know, you mentioned your son, and as a father, you know, I just found out. Well, recently found out. Me and my wife are expecting our first child.
Sick. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. One of the things I've asked other father, like fathers and things like that, they always, you know, there's no fucking manual out there. There's nothing that says here's how to be the best father. Just so you do, maybe with the other kids. What are some of the lessons or things you would relay on about being a father, and you know, some things you see you out?
Okay, well, this is a really great analogy. It's like you go from being an expecting dad, and then in like, depending on how long the labor is, to like, mm-hmm. here you go, here's the baby. Like, what, like, you know, you're all stoked, you're like, we're gonna have a baby, it's gonna be awesome, and you're thinking all this shit, and then the next thing you know, the baby's in your arms, and you're like, every thought of like, I'm not ready for this floods in your head, like, what do I do, like, right, how does it eat, like, you know, it's but it's a crazy journey. And the best quote that I've ever heard about being a dad, and it kind of like, now that my kids are older, it means a lot more to me, is that the days are long, but the years are short. And especially when you have a newborn, you and your wife, you're going to be like, I didn't realize that there was a 48 hour day, you know, yeah. Like, you're just like, oh, I did, how many days with that? Oh, it was only an hour, you know, because you're running on no sleep. You're running with no manual. I don't know, like, hopefully you guys have some help, like, you know, your brother or your mom and dad live nearby. Mm-hmm. It's basically just, you know, you kind of figure it out. It's trial by fire.
Yeah.
It's really trial by fire. That's why kid number two, a lot of people, and then kid number three, they're like, I don't know where he is. Is he around here somewhere? You know, it's like, like, you begin to like have kind of like, you know, a more comfortability, a more relaxed approach to it. And you'll find, cause you know, having two kids is easier. It's a goddamn war zone in the beginning, but like eventually it becomes easier, but you know, you'll find with your second child that the stuff that you pushed on your first child, you're a lot more lenient with, you know, because you figure, what's worse can happen? People that have like two or three kids.
I feel that. Yeah. My brother will tell you too. That's because like we're the two youngest, so like I definitely understand that for sure. It's kind of like,
yeah. Your parents are just like, yeah, you can let him roll around in the in the mercury. He'll be fine.
He'll be good. He'll be good.
Yeah, he'll be good.
Last question, and thank you so much for sharing that. Very excited.
Dude, no worries.
Last question of the podcast, and thank you again for being on here.
Absolutely.
I like asking a question for everyone because it's a silly kind of fun question. You never know what you're going to get. So, you know, similar to that scene in the movie Step Brothers where Brennan and Dale roll up to the playground and they have to face all the elementary school kids. In a similar kind of situation, how many fifth graders do you think you could fight before they take over and like overpower you?
You just made me eat white dog crap.
Exactly.
How many fifth graders do I think I could take?
Yeah,
dude, man. I kind of think about this stuff randomly. I think I could take like probably 10 fifth graders, dude. But that's it depends. Like, not these like new school like mutant fifth graders that are like, they're shaving in fifth grade. You know what I mean? But like average size fifth graders, I'd probably take like 10.
Yeah.
Because you can really fool them. You know, you can do the fake out trip. Like they're so dumb in fifth grade, man. You can just like whip those kids around. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I agree. That's a respectful.
I get 10.
Yeah. I respect that. And what about, I want to check in with you on this answer. How many think you can take?
Yeah. I mean, last time we talked about this was a few episodes ago, I said 10 to 15. I think I'm going to stay with that. I mean,
15 might be a bit much to handle. You can be overwhelmed by 15.
Right?
Well, like, to your point, it's a different, fifth graders are different nowadays. Like you said, I feel like I'm just remembering how we all grew up. But I'm sticking with 10 to 15. I'm staying strong.
Dude, I kind of look at it like Walking Dead. You know, you're like, yeah, right? I could fully take on like 10 zombies, but they are very intimidating in numbers.
Yeah.
So
and right, the more there are, the harder it might get. Two aspects of this question that kind of recently were raised to me. One, I saw kind of what you were saying. One person responded back to like in a comment for like one of these and was like, a fifth grade Mississippian boy could easily mess you up. And I was like, well, I'm not talking about, yeah, those corn-fed boys. Like, those dudes are...
a lot of whole milk. Not these whole milk kids. Like, right. We're talking average.
I'm not...
Raised on Fortnite. I could take, like, 10 Fortnite kids.
So, I was going to say, to that point, like, another friend of mine brought up a good point. Like, kids nowadays, like, and a little bit to what you said, you know, you could definitely from, like, as you're going on in this fight, mentally you have an edge on them a little bit, like you said,
right?
Like, they're the Fortnite kids. You could probably take a handful of more of those down because of, you know, mentally, like psychologically, you could not so much like mentally break them down, but like psychologically you could get in their head a little bit easier. And I was like, that is an interesting perspective for that. That is a different part that you could definitely, you know, go after for them.
You can't discount a fifth grader's stamina though. They have a lot more stamina.
Yeah,
but here I am. I'm just picturing like picking one up and throwing it at the other fifth graders like that.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff that's going on in my head right now.
I get that.
Taking down some fifth graders.
And you can take down another 4 or 5 with one chuck like that. I mean,
right? That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. But they don't stay down. That's the problem with fifth graders. They don't
get
stay
back
down.
Up. They're limber. Yeah. They're loose and limber. I get. And you never know if they're coming like straight from recess or lunch or something like that. Mm. They got that energy.
Yeah.
But thank you for answering that question. I respect that answer. That's a great, respectable answer. Before I let you go, is there anything else you wanted to share? Anything else that you had that, you know, you wanted to share with people? But you've been a great guest. So thank you.
I guess I'll plug our podcast. I have a podcast. It's called The Monday Mass. It's on Spotify and Apple and all the other places where you can find it, and it's at The Monday Mass on Instagram, and it's me and my friend Chris, and it's an action sports show about nothing. It's the framework is action sports, but we talk about it's basically like it's kind of like talking about attacking fifth graders like the whole time.
That's the best part.
There's nothing in there that it goes off on tangents beyond tangents. So it's kind of a fun listen. So yeah, the Monday Mass with Chris Cote and Todd Richards.
I'm definitely going to tune into that for sure. That's going to subscribe right away. That's fucking awesome. Yeah. But you're a friend of the pod. You're welcome back anytime. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
we'll be listening to you and commentating for sure. And with that, we'll head to the outro. But thank you so much for coming. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, boys. We'll see you later.
Yeah, appreciate it. Peace.